From the KCPW Danker Studios at Library Square, this is Downtown SLC, a show that explores the people, places, and events shaping Utah's urban center. I'm your host, Jason Mathis. The Utah Legislature is just around the corner, and joining me today will be Representative Rebecca Chavez-Houck, who represents downtown at the legislature. We'll be talking about big legislative trends, we'll be talking about the legislation that may come out that will impact downtown Salt Lake City, and we'll be talking about what the future holds. We'll also spend a little time talking about former Speaker Becky Lockhart, whose memorial service will be going on during this program, and the role that she played in helping to build a stronger Utah. All of that after this news from the BBC. Welcome back. You're listening to Downtown SLC on KCPW. I'm your host, Jason Mathis, with the Downtown Alliance, joined today by my very dear friend, Representative Rebecca Chavez-Houck. Rebecca, thanks for being here.
Hey, Jason. Thanks for the invitation.
I did want to point out we are pre-recording today because this show is going to be airing during the memorial service for Speaker Becky Lockhart, former Speaker Rebecca Lockhart. And Rebecca, I wanted to give you just a chance to maybe share a little bit about your feelings with the audience about Speaker Lockhart.
Well, I mean, this is such a horrific tragedy, and her passing is so untimely. It's been a very tough a couple of weeks. I mean, we knew that she was ill, and just within this last week, there's been a pall that has settled over the Capitol, I have to say.
The whole legislature.
Everybody, not just the legislature, just everyone that works on the campus, everybody that has known her, all the staff that works with the legislature, our colleagues in the executive branch, everyone. So it is very tragic. But you know, the way that I look at it anyway is taking her legacy and moving it forward. Mm-hmm. She was so committed to continuing work related to encouraging women to run for office and to speak to their power. I mean, that's one thing that she just felt very strongly about, as she would talk to new legislators, but particularly women, is to own their power and to show it. And she was a very clear example of that.
She embodied that.
And so it's our job to continue that. Another thing that I reflect upon at this time is how much she loved the institution of the legislature, and especially the House. She was totally dedicated to our traditions and fiercely defended what it meant, you know, the institution and its role in our democracy. And so those are the types of things that I've been reflecting on over the past few days. And yeah, it's going to be a very emotional, you know, well, the beginning day, I mean, the whole session will be struggling through that. But I know the first day of the session is going to be very emotional and very somber. There is a formality that exists on the first day.
Sure.
And I think that's going to be the overlay of sadness and reflection that will be there for all of us who have served with her will be there. I've been trying to steel myself in preparation for that. But as you know, as our colleague Senator Bramble has mentioned over the past few days, she would want us to pick up and move on and to get with it. And you know, she'd be just kind of like letting us, like, come on, get over yourself and let's go.
Yeah.
So I try to remember that's what she would be saying to us in my mind. I shouldn't try to assume that, but that's in my head. That's what I would think she would be asking us to do, and to do our job. And even though we often disagreed on policy issues and were pretty different ideologically, she was a very collaborative leader, and would call upon us in the Democratic caucus to share our perspectives, and was very communicative and was always very direct. You never knew. I mean, you never doubted where she was at.
And she didn't play games.
That's what you expect and hope to have from your colleagues on the Hill, is just that straightforward. forward and no holds barred and no doubt about where a person stands. And that's the way she was. She was real.
Yeah. The two major legislative issues I've been interested in over the past couple of years, one was immigration, and you and I have a real shared interest in that. And she was really just such a champion on that issue in so many ways, and often defied her own political base and her own political party to do what she thought was right.
Yeah.
And then the convention hotel. And I remember last year when she stood up and said, I'm supporting this, before the session even started, and had a media event with Mayor McAdams. You and I got to serve together on the Immigration Commission, and I always kind of liked sitting by Speaker Lockhart in that, because she was kind of snarky. Like, I think it's okay to say that. She she understood people, and she didn't mind calling people out, and it was refreshing.
She told it like it was, and that's
really
that it was refreshing, and when she was on your side of the issue, it was great. It was great. Yeah. She was an amazing champion for the things that she held dear and about which she felt most strongly. So
will
be missed.
Very open to junior members of the legislature and to Democrats and people who may have a different political ideology. I think, as you said, incredibly collaborative and wanted to know what people thought. Even if she disagreed, she really cared about your opinion and your values.
Well, and she appreciated the individual strengths of each legislator. I mean, she knew where they were at, what their strengths were, and she tried to cultivate that, encourage that, and be very open with people about allowing them to shine if they were willing to follow the rules in the process.
Right. Well, obviously today our thoughts are with you as a colleague, a former colleague of the speaker, and then obviously Stan, her husband, and her
definitely.
Family. Yeah,
definitely.
We're sure thinking about them. As you start thinking about this session, it's coming up next week. Ready for it or not, it's going to be here.
Once again,
what do you see as some of the big issues that you think you and your colleagues will be grappling with this year?
Well, I see this session as kind of the session of bold initiative. And I say that because, you know, we're exploring so many, especially in terms of the budget and revenue enhancements, looking at the gas tax, Representative Drackler's proposal related to education and an income tax increase. We are looking at all of these things that have sometimes been seen as a third rail of sorts, and just saying, let's be bold and let's take a look at this. Let's reassess. We've had a period of challenge and of being careful. Austerity, you know, just being very careful about how we spend our money. And we're still going to be very fiscally responsible about that. And that's something we feel very strongly about as about Democrats. In fact, we're kind of surprised by the boldness that we're seeing from our colleagues on the other side of the aisle in terms of saying, okay, we bit the bullet during the tough years. Now, what can we do to support the growth and the opportunity that exists within our state by looking at some of these things like the increase in the gas tax and maybe looking at increasing income tax and those types of things. So,
you know, it's interesting, and any smart business owner will tell you, there are sometimes when you do want to conserve and sometimes when you have to invest.
Jump.
If you want to be successful, there are times when you need to put money on the table and make an investment in the future. And you're feeling that in this session.
Yeah. I mean, at least that's what's been put forward. I don't know at the end of the day how bold everybody is going to be about this, but the fact that we're even having these conversations.
It's not just Democrats saying this.
That's the thing. What's been so surprising to me.
Yeah.
I'm heartened by it, and it's just kind of intriguing. I'm trying to figure out how we navigate when there is this new world of our colleagues on the other side of the aisle of them say, no, this is what we need to do. We need to bite the bullet. We need to bite it big and go forward the session. So it'll be an intriguing dialogue moving forward.
Yeah. It's education is one issue that, you know, always a big issue. The major bulk of our expenditures as a state go to education, and yet we always seem to be lagging behind in per pupil spending, and we started to see test scores falling, and I know a lot of business leaders downtown and really throughout the state are saying, we don't know that we're always going to have the workforce that we need to be successful if we don't invest. So you have fairly conservative business leaders that for a few years now have been saying, hey, legislature, we know you're conservative, we know you're thrifty, we know you're fiscally prudent, all those things are great, but this is a really important issue for us to be successful, for our economy as a state to continue to grow. And if we're going to continue to lead the nation, we got to make sure that we're covering the basics and educating these kids.
Well, the way I look at it is, you know, it's about competition. It's about making yourself competitive as a regional player and as a national and international player. And I've always said you've got to get away from this notion of what I call bargain basement education. You know, you just can't. We're efficient. We are so efficient. We're so efficient that we are at a point of diminishing returns at this point.
Our teachers do a great job for what we give them and the resources they have. It's extraordinary. And think how much better it would be if they actually had the resources that other states gave to their
teachers. And I find it so intriguing. A lot of the talk has been over the past few years of encouraging and setting the stage, the foundation. Stage for students to not only complete their high school, but moving into higher education, looking at post-secondary education. And I'm extremely excited about the proposal that the president has put forward.
I find it
really interesting because there's been such talk at the state level about everybody's got to get this post-secondary certification, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the best mechanisms by which people can do that, young people and people returning to school can do this, is through the community colleges. And I was actually listening to Marco Rubio, Senator Rubio, the other day, was kind of really dissing, for lack of a better way of putting it, the community college system and saying, well, you know, we don't want to invest the money in that. And it's like, and he was talking about certification and those associate degrees, et cetera. And he was saying, well, you know, that I don't know whether that's really the way we want to go. And I'm like going, here's the opportunity. And here is another way that we can leverage support from the federal government, add it, make it additive to what we're already doing, find a way to make it our own, and really push through that sticking point that seems to be there in terms of people getting those through those first 2 years of college.
Absolutely. And we have such an incredible and successful community college. Salt Lake Community College is extraordinary. I think most people don't realize the depth and breadth of what they do for our community.
Precisely.
It's extraordinary. By sheer numbers, they're the biggest college in the state of Utah. I think 60,000 students, campuses scattered across the Salt Lake Valley. And the work that they do to help get people ready for college, or if they're not interested in college, get them an associate's degree to go out into the workforce.
Or a certification, something along those lines. To just, it's additive.
It's
and so
remarkable.
So I see that as a great opportunity. And I hope that we won't close the door on that. I hope that we'll look at a way to leverage that support from the federal government and say, yes, this moves us closer to that goal of that 2020 goal.
Yeah. Prosperity 2020 led by the business community, 66%.
What a great opportunity. Yep. So I'm hoping that, you know, that's I'm just so I am really excited about that option. And I just I hope that, like with Healthy Utah and Medicaid expansion, that we don't just completely dismiss it just because of where it's coming from.
We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about Healthy Utah and a host of other issues. Joining me today, my friend, Representative Rebecca Chavez Houck. Rebecca represents downtown, among other Salt Lake City neighborhoods in the state legislature. And we're talking about what to expect in the session next week. And we'll be back after these messages. We are back. You're listening to Downtown SLC on KCPW. I'm your host, Jason Mathis, with the Downtown Alliance. And joining me today is my dear friend, Rebecca Chavez Houck. She is the representative at the state legislature who represents downtown and the avenues and do parts of Rose Park as well?
No, I-15 is my west boundary. Okay. So
Guadalupe,
Capitol Hill, Federal Heights, a little bit of the university.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for being here. We appreciate
always
it.
Always a pleasure. Thanks.
We are talking about the legislative session that starts on Monday. And I wanted to just make a plug for Healthy Utah, the governor's initiative that would incorporate some aspects of the Affordable Care Act. You know, one of the issues that we really grapple with in downtown as the regional headquarters for homeless services are people who have severe mental illness and who do not have the medications that they need to effectively manage that. And one thing that I'm really just hoping and begging the legislature, not you, because I know you're supportive already, it's preaching to the choir, but maybe some of your colleagues, is really to take a look at this and realize the huge negative impact on the economy that it has to have lots of people who desperately need help and have a mechanism that could help them and to turn our backs on that and walk away from that when it's money that we've already paid to the federal government in taxes. It seems insane to me, but Maybe you can help me understand the rationale for this idea of rejecting this money.
Well, and the interesting turn of events that has occurred over the last month and a half or so, 2 months, is that a number of my colleagues, those I serve with on the Health Reform System Task Force, have kind of taken a new direction, mm-hmm. That we're calling Frail Utah, because what they want to do is focus primarily on the medically frail. And actually, a number of the people that you're identifying, these the individuals, the homeless population, folks that really suffer from very severe mental illness and other very difficult chronic diseases, will possibly be helped. But the challenge is by not helping everybody within the coverage gap, you're not sharing the risk.
Right.
And it's going to end up costing us a lot more per person just to assist the medically frail. And, you know, a lot of the pushback that I get from why aren't we bringing this other more healthy population of working people who just can't make the premiums and provide those subsidies as are proposed with the governor's plan and really have a very rich portfolio of individuals that we're covering to share that risk,
right.
And to help spread around the cost is what I'm getting at. And, you know, the pushback that I get is, well, we can't help everyone. You know, we're going to help the most severely ill. But to me, it situates us in a place that we're going to always be taking care of the very ill, because the people that were not quite so ill don't get health care when they need it. And then they become medically frail. And so it just really will be, in my opinion, a very bad cycle. And I'm trying to understand the common sense of it. It's real. You know, they'll argue the numbers in terms of the fact that long term, we can't care for everybody in this under 103% of the federal poverty level population, this coverage gap. But my argument would be, let's take care of everybody, because if you get some people well sooner rather than later, they can be assisting and contributing into the system and helping those people that are medically frail. And just the whole situation with turning back the funding and not taking that 100% that the federal government is offering us, the millions, the hundreds of millions of dollars of our own tax dollars. And Western states, we're not talking liberal bastions, we're talking Arizona, we're talking Nevada, we're talking New Mexico. Every single Western state except for Idaho has jumped onto this. Again, looking at regional competition, looking at shoring up infrastructure that makes sure that we have a healthy workforce, that people are at the top of their game, so that we can continue forward in terms of this economic prosperity that we've been afforded. It just really flies back in the face of that. I just don't understand it.
So my interest is downtown, but it relates to every neighborhood across the state.
No, definitely.
That people will be impacted in your town, in your community.
Well, the thing that continues to surprise me is if you look at arguments from the conservative side of the aisle in other states, I mean, you look at someone like Jan Brewer, who is not, you know, she's terribly conservative.
Yeah.
And she saw the benefit to supporting her rural counties with this.
Right.
I mean, totally saw the benefit of it. Any of these Republican-led states, that have moved forward with the expansion, that has been their argument. It's like, it's our money. We're bringing it back. It helps us take care of many of our populations that aren't taken care of now. And those rural communities, it's such a huge impact. And you talk to the Utah Association of Counties. You know, they've been supportive of the governor's plan for a number of months. So it's like everybody's on the bandwagon except for a selected few joining me on the Hill.
Yeah.
And the thing is that there are other states that are eyeballing the work that we've done. So are we going to put all of our effort, the work that's gone into the hours and the money, the resources that have gone into this compromise and these discussions and these negotiations, and then let some other state take advantage of for the benefit of their population?
Right.
I find that very, very frustrating.
It's frustrating. We will we'll continue to monitor that. What else do you think is going to be an interesting conversation?
You know, it's going to be interesting. These issues related to religious liberties.
Mm-hmm.
We're keeping a cautious eye as to how those proposals are moving forward. We have grave concerns. In our caucus, I would say, predominantly, I can't speak for the caucus in its entirety because we haven't taken a specific stand on it. But we just want to assure that constitutional protections are there for individuals that want to be able to exercise what is now the law of the land at present until the Supreme Court rules rules otherwise.
And this is gay marriage that
this
we're talking
about.
This
is gay marriage and assuring that constitutionally elected officials protect those rights.
Government officials have an obligation to support the Constitution.
Right. Period. Yeah. Yeah. And so that's going to be intriguing to see where that goes. My colleague, Representative King, is running a resolution related to affirming religious liberties the way that many of the founders espoused them, including Thomas Jefferson, who was very clear on that differentiation between church and state.
Yeah.
So trying to take a different spin of really reflecting on it in that way. This whole discussion related to last year's SB 54, the caucus convention system.
Yeah, the count my vote.
Count my vote and compromise. Yeah. And discussions related to suits that have been moved forward with by the Republican Party to help move that back. Heartened to hear that folks from across the political spectrum would like to just leave it the way it was and the work that we did last year, let it stand. And so I'm happy to hear that. Although I am a Democrat, I feel very strongly about supporting and affirming the rights of unaffiliated voters in particular, and I think we found a way of doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you have the preponderance of voters in our state being unaffiliated, it just really kind of I have a visceral reaction to this notion of you have to pick a party.
Yeah.
I mean, what is that?
Right.
I mean, I don't care for that at all. Well, I don't think any individual should be forced to choose a party in order to fully participate in the selection of people that go onto the ballot. So, I'm happy with the compromise. I mean, there's some things that I felt that could have been done to make it a little bit more rigorous and supportive for unaffiliated voters, but I felt that we were moving in the right direction. And the suit that we're looking at right now that the Republican Party has presented, I just think is, it's not us acting in good faith. And if there is legislation that has been set forth that we might be looking at to repeal, and I find that very offensive.
Yeah. It feels like that was kind of put to bed and maybe it's time to move on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Well, thank you so much. Good luck next week.
Thank you.
We'll keep in touch and continue to monitor progress. And of course, we really appreciate your leadership and your support of downtown. You do a great job representing our community and really caring for our urban center. And we're delighted to have you as our representative. So thank you so much.
Great. Thank you.
Keep up the good work.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Downtown SLC on KCPW. Join us every Thursday at 10 o'clock where we talk about the people, places, and events shaping Utah's urban center.